Is that there's a couple other meetings going on, Health and Human Services and K-12 education. But there, we'd like to take this opportunity to go over a couple of areas relating to the things that we will be dealing with as a capital investment or a bonding committee. And one of them is to get an overview from the management and budget.
That's right.
On the process, get a little better understanding of where we're at in terms of the existing bonds that are out there, the types of bonds, and whatever else that would come up. And I think the more we understand of the different or the information, that we can make a good decision in the end. So I'd like to invite is it Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, thank you, Kristen Hansen, if you would go ahead and hopefully everything is set up. Oh, I apologize. On the agenda, we had Minnesota or the Public Facilities Authorities first, but I think we should go ahead with your presentation if you're ready.
Chairman, I'm kind of ready. I just need to put in my PowerPoint presentation, and I'm being somewhat inept.
Members, we have some coffee, if you'd like, right over along here. There's.
It was upside down.
Jesus Christ. Holy balls. You don't get any help yet?
Got money?
Can't get a handle on it, can we?
Yeah. Oh.
For the record, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I just need to get my slideshow up. And you should also have copies of this that should have been distributed that you can work off of. And just so you know, I've also added three attachments to the back of the presentation. So when the numbers look really small on your handouts, there's actually a bigger version, so you don't have to try to squint to read it. I'm here to provide some background to the Committee on Capital Investment and State Bonding. And so we're just going to start with the basics. Public finance is a complicated field. I've been doing this for almost 20 years, but I just want to start with what is a bond? And municipal bonds are debt securities that are issued by states, local governments, counties, other governmental entities to finance capital projects such as buildings, schools, highways, utility systems, or to fund day-to-day operations. And the agreement is that the bond issuer, and so in this case we'll be talking about the state, agrees to pay interest and the return on the investment, which is the original principal amount, to the bondholders who have loaned the issuer money for the projects. And I had been a financial advisor for local governments for over 17 years, and it works a lot like mortgages or loans, personal loans, with lots of rules attached. Some of the characteristics that you see with bonds is, you know, who the issuer is, state, municipalities, special districts, the purpose of the bonds, what the bond proceeds are going to be used for. You can see examples here. what the credit structure or the source of repayment is, and you see our general obligation bonds, which are paid for from the state's essentially general fund, revenue bonds, which are paid for by a specific revenue stream, and annual appropriations, and I'll get into more details on that later. The maturity structure, and that talks about whether the bonds are serial bonds and term bonds, and I think when I start to get into some of this minutia, this is where you need your coffee. Serial bonds are kind of the traditional bonds. When we sell our GOs, we often see, you know, bonds maturing, principal maturing every year with an interest rate assigned to it. Term bonds means when the investors are purchasing the bonds, they will combine what we call block sizes. So if we sell a 20-year bond, they might combine, you know, three of the maturities, say 2017, 18, and 19, so that they have what's called a bigger block size. They can add the principal amounts of those 3 years because they may have investors that want to see a larger what we call block size or amount of principal. Price, in our offering documents, when we bring bonds to market, you'll hear about bonds being sold at a discount, at par, at premium. Just so you know, Minnesota GO bonds cannot be sold at a discount. A lot of you that, you know, have communities where your local governments sell bonds, they are able to sell bonds at a discount. We sell our bonds at par, so that means that the underwriters can't take a discount, which is like points on a mortgage, just so you know when I talk about discount. And in this current interest rate environment, we're seeing what's called premium. As you know, interest rates on municipal bonds are very low, so they're good for an issuer, so happy from the state perspective, not so good from an investor standpoint. But in order to put higher coupons on the bonds, which look more favorable to investors, the purchaser of the bonds, the underwriter, gives money up front to the issuer so that they can do that. And all of those get taken into the situation when determining how much it's going to cost the borrower. Tax status. Bonds can be sold as either taxable or tax exempt. When legislators are talking about, you know, the bonding bill and capital projects, the intent is that we can sell them as tax exempt. It's obviously a lower cost to the tax, to the state, and from a Minnesota standpoint, if they're tax exempt, they're tax exempt from both a federal tax income tax perspective, but if you're a Minnesota resident that buys a Minnesota tax exempt bond, it's also tax exempt for Minnesota income taxes. So that results in lower interest rates to the issuer.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one brief clarification. You said that Minnesota GO bonds cannot be sold at a discount.
Correct.
But can they be sold at a premium, especially in this environment, or just par?
Sanson.
Chair, Senator, yes, they can be sold at a premium.
Thank you.
So when you're talking about, you know, projects, and I'll get more into kind of the constitutional requirements about, you know, what the projects can be used for. There are situations where there's private use and things like that, that we, when we're issuing bonds, we have to do that analysis to make sure that we can issue them as tax exempt bonds, but there may be circumstances which involves detailed tax analysis where some of the bonds may have to be issued as taxable. So just so you're aware of that, we know that your intent is, if we can issue them as tax exempt, we will. But depending on a lot of circumstances involving a bond issue, they may have to be issued as taxable. And the Rural Finance Authority does issue taxable bonds for some of their bond programs because of its benefiting, you know, private entities. Interest rates.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you. So what's an example of a situation where you have to issue a taxable bond?
Chair, Senator, probably when it comes to, I'm going to use the stadium legislation because obviously you have, you know, a private, you know, entity and tax law, when you start talking about naming rights and paying for those or kind of private suites where it's going to be used by the private, we're going to have to do a very careful tax analysis on that because they a portion of bonds may have to be taxable because of that private use. And tax counsel does a very careful analysis because we don't want to get in trouble with the IRS to make sure, you know, that it's very delineated and clear what the tax-exempt bonds will be used for and the taxable bonds. So anytime there's private use, example at my house is that my husband works for the University of Minnesota in facilities, and I said, well, you can't just have a Starbucks in a bond finance property if there's geo bonds. So, I mean, there's lots of things that we have to consider on our end to protect the state and do analysis, working with appropriate individuals to do that analysis. Interest rates can be either fixed rate or variable. Most, if not all, of the bonds that the state issues are fixed rate bonds, so you don't see them changing over time, you know, and it's depending on market conditions. So the state issues fixed rate bonds. You may have seen other issues do variable rate bonds, and that's to be able to kind of capture, you know, where the market is if it's a low interest rate environment, but you also kind of risk that if the market goes up. But the state tends to be pretty conservative on what they issue and how they issue. And for our geo bonds, we do not have the ability to issue those as variable rate. And then the term of the bonds talks about how long the bonds are outstanding. So you talk about long or short term for our geo bonds. By constitution, they can only be 20 years in length. But you may see some financings that are for shorter, you know, terms. You know, you'll see 5-10-year bonds. We don't see them as often here at the state level, but you will see different terms and lengths. You may see this, you know, with your local governments. If your school district's issuing capital facility bonds, they can only be 10 years.
Commissioner, do you know what the current interest rate is?
Chairman, I don't know off the top of my head, but when we sold our GEO bonds back in August, they were
2.6.
They were just over like 2%. They're very favorable. Rates have come up since then, but we're in a very favorable tax-exempt interest rate environment now.
Thank you. Senator Metzen?
Now might be the time to ask. How many dollars amount do you have out there in bonding today? And you just mentioned the favorable rates. Are you calling those and replacing them with those 2 or 2.5%? Are they callable if you want to redo them? Are we redoing them, and what kind of money are we saving the state of Minnesota?
Chairman, Senator, I will be talking about that in more detail, but when we do bring bonds to market, we actually set what's called a call feature or a redemption feature, which basically says what bonds that we have issued can be refinanced or called at what price and when. Most of our geo bonds have what's called a 10-year call. So when we go to market, we don't allow all the bonds to be refinanceable because bondholders are going to say, if I can buy a 20-year bond that has a 10-year call or a Minnesota bond that doesn't have a call feature and can be called at any time, as an investor, I'm going to want a bond that I'm going to know I can hold for a while and get my return on investment. I am going to talk about refundings, but we are always monitoring refundings. The underwriting community is always sending me runs. But I'll get into kind of some of the timing. But we do look at that, and we do look at possible savings.
Chairman, we'll talk about the savings a little later on, what you've redone and what it's saving the taxpayers of Minnesota. Okay.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Hansen, before you maybe leave that last slide, I just wanted to go back to Senator Tomasoni's question a little bit on the taxable or tax-exempt bonds and maybe try to understand a little bit more what you probably said. I'm trying to think of some examples. In any event, if we were to bond for a facility, be it college or anything else, and if it had private sector tenants, I guess they could lease space within the building. But if they actually developed space in the building, if they built, I don't know, a new kitchen or whatever within shell space, you get where I'm going? Does that somehow affect whether these are taxable bonds or not taxable bonds?
Chairman, Senator, It's unfortunately the tax-exempt IRS regulations are not black and white, and so it has to do with not only, you know, private use, who is using the facility, but it also goes to where the revenue stream is. And so we have to really look at everything on a case-by-case basis with tax attorneys to determine, you know, what percentage is being used by private users, what the lease agreement is with the, you know, grantee, and things like that. So it's not, unfortunately, it's not a black and white answer, but it's a more detailed analysis that's very circumstantial, project by project.
Mr. Chair, would it be reasonable to say that if a building were used somewhat substantially by private sector that had been publicly developed under state bonding, GO bonds, and so on, that maybe that might be a problem?
Chairman, Senator, yes, if there was a substantial use of the facility by a private entity, depending how the lease agreement is set up, that would be something that we would look at very carefully.
Thank you.
Minnesota Constitution Article 11, Sections 4, 5, and 7 have the sections for GO bonding. Article 14 is for our trunk highway bonds that are also issued as GOs. And there's nothing in our state constitution that talks about other types of bond issues, just so you know. Minnesota statutes for our GO bonds, 16A, contains additional language for our GO bonding. Some of our kind of statutory guidelines, and there's other types of bond issues that are included in 16A or in separate chapters as well. And then we are dictated by various federal regulations in terms of, you know, IRS regulations, Securities Exchange Commission regulations, which involve kind of disclosure. And I will talk briefly later. So there's a lot of rules that kind of dictate the issuance of bonds. It's kind of a complicated field that, like I said, this is something I deal with every day, and, you know, you touch on it, and so feel free to ask questions. As I told the chair, I could talk a lot about bonds.
Commissioner, when you said that there were no Constitution was limited in terms of what it talked about. Were you making reference to the appropriation bond kind of expansion of in the last few years?
I will be talking about that later, but just in terms of the state constitution provides kind of the guidelines and kind of rules about general obligation bonds, and I'm going to start talking about that on this slide. So what projects are eligible for state GO bond financing? And Article 11, Section 5 of the Constitution contains the authority for incurring public debt, which is GO bonds. And Subdivision A of that section states that it's to acquire and to better public lands and buildings and other public improvements of a capital nature and to provide money to be appropriated or loaned to any agency or political subdivision of the state. So in other words, the bond finance property must be publicly owned. The project must constitute a capital expenditure. The project must be for a public purpose, and the purpose of the bonds must be clearly set forth in law. And this refers to actually specific projects you'll see in the riders for bond authorizations, as well as other kind of state programs that exist out there that qualify for bond financing, GO bond financing. As you know, for this particular section of the Constitution, Subdivision A, it requires 3/5 vote of both the House and Senate to pass bonding bills. Subdivision B of that same section of the Constitution has a number of other purposes for which GO bonds may be issued. Here's kind of some background on it and when they were put in place, like to repel invasion or suppress insurrection. That was 1857. Trunk highway bonds are in this section as well. That's to establish and maintain highways. The trunk highway bonds are actually backed by the trunk highway fund, but they're also general obligations. So from a bondholder's standpoint, you know, you have kind of, you'd call these double-barreled in the public finance world. But they are GO bonds. And this particular subdivision of the Constitution does not require the three-fifths vote.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sendrum?
And not to dwell on too long, but the second to the last one about, you know, we have a lot of discussion around here about light rail, high-speed rail, and so on. What does that really say? That, I mean, I can read it, but what does it really say?
This is kind of
related to rail.
Commissioner?
This is, Chairman, Senator, this is talking about kind of railroads, and I don't, you know, and I would have to look back on this for you to get a definite answer, but I will definitely
That's fine. No problem.
That. And you can share that with the full committee. Some other important provisions that pertain to GO bonds. It's a full faith and credit obligation of the state. The state will levy a tax if necessary to meet its debt service obligations. This is actually in the Constitution. However, what the state does is before December 1st, every year we make a general fund transfer to the debt service fund to make our bond payments that's equivalent to 18 months of debt service. So we have money to pay bonds 18 months out. And bondholders really value that because not only are they a GO pledge where if we didn't have the money to make the debt service payments, the state is authorized to make a tax levy over all of its taxpayers, which is the crux of a GO bond in general, whether it's the state or a local government. But we have enough money to make 18 months worth of debt service payments, which is really, from a bondholder standpoint, really talks about the security of our bonds. As I indicated before, the maximum maturity on our GO bonds is 20 years. And as I stated when we were talking about the constitutional provision, is that each bond issue must distinctly specify the purposes and maximum amount of proceeds authorized to be expended for such purposes. And there is a special and separate state bond fund for debt service. It's our debt service fund. And we also have, when we sell the bonds, so the debt service fund is used to pay principal and interest, but when we sell bonds, the bond proceeds actually goes into a bond proceeds fund, and that's what's used to pay for the projects authorized in the bonding bills.
Senator Thomas, only.
If the purchaser of a bond wants to sell the bonds before the 20-year maturity, do they lose? Is there a penalty for it for doing that, or is it possible to do it even?
Chair, Senator, in regards to bondholders, and I'm going to kind of give you some background, is when we sell bonds, we actually sell them for the most part competitively. So we go out to the market, and underwriting firms will actually bid on the bonds based on the specifications set forward. Those firms that buy the bonds are buying them for their own portfolios or they're buying them for the secondary market, whether it's an individual investor or a mutual fund or an insurance company. So at the secondary market level, there's trading on municipal bonds going on all the time. And so that they can do that, whether they're going through their broker or if a mutual fund is selling off some of the pieces of their bonds. So that's happening all the time. So that can happen, and it does happen.
Senator Thomas.
So there's no penalty for doing it then?
When we sell our bonds with the call date, there is no penalty for us to kind of refinance those. Our call feature is that we're going to refinance them at par, at the same value. Some bond issues will have a prepayment penalty. When it comes to the secondary market, they're more taking an interest rate risk versus a penalty. So the trading on the secondary market is going on all the time, and depending what the market condition is, you know, the prices change on the secondary market. So it may not be, they may be benefiting it, you know, on that trade, depending on what the market conditions are, they may be taking a loss. But that's happening at the secondary level and not at the, you know, the issuer level.
Commissioner?
This slide talks about all the different state bond issuers that have the authority to actually issue debt I mean, obviously, the Commissioner of MMB has the authority. Public Facilities Authority has the authority to issue debt, and they'll be talking to you after my presentation. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency does, the Office of Higher Ed, MNSCU, the Ag and Economic Development Authority, the Rural Finance Authority, IRRRB, the State Armory Commission, Higher Ed Facilities, and then the Tobacco Securitization Authority, which was established when we sold the tobacco securitization bonds. And then in addition, the University of Minnesota is not on here because it's not a state agency, but they also have their own authority to issue their own debt. So the state has debt policies and informal practices that we follow. I'm going to talk in more detail about the capital investment guidelines. This will actually go to what kind of bonds we have outstanding and, you know, talk about how the guidelines work. We have implemented back in 2012 tax compliance policies and procedures. The IRS has ramped up its review of tax-exempt borrowers. And in the past 5 years, they have actually created a tax-exempt bonding division of the IRS, and they have added many new auditors to take a look at how issuers are using their tax-exempt bonds to make sure that they're in compliance. And so they have been sending out surveys to different types of issuers. They've been, but what we're seeing on the surveys, and I'm talking from my past life as a financial advisor because the state hasn't gotten a survey, but they're now asking, now that one of the first questions is, do you have tax compliance policies and procedures in place? And so, you know, our responsibility is to protect the state and to make sure that we are using our proceeds appropriately, you know, in terms of IRS regulations. And so this is the increased regulations and procedures from the IRS and other federal regulators, you know, affects kind of our workload and what we're doing to protect the state. Refunding criteria, this goes to Senator Metzen's question about, you know, what are we doing? We continually monitor the opportunities to refund bonds to save the state money to reduce our debt service payments. And our informal guidelines are that we'd like to see a 5% present value savings over time and a 3% savings by maturity. We're all, like I said, we're always monitoring them. And kind of in relation, the last bullet point is timing of bond sales. We traditionally do not sell bonds during the legislative session. There's a lot of things going on that are what are called disclosure items from an underwriting perspective. As you know, there's the economic forecast coming out, so we traditionally do not sell bonds during the 25-day window before that, because if you sell bonds, something may change at the time of the forecast. And so if you do sell bonds in that period, we call stickering the OS with lots of disclaimers saying, this is what we know now, but there's information coming out. You know, sometimes there's legislation introduced that may affect bond issues. When I was a financial advisor, when legislation's passed for, you know, putting a freeze on levies for issuers of bonds, you know, that affects what your local government issuers can do for the sale of bonds. So because there could be changes at the legislative level, we traditionally don't sell during the legislative session just because of timing. But right now the interest rate, you know, environment is favorable, and we could see, you know, significant savings. I'm trying to think. All the underwriters, they send me numbers. I don't read all of their emails because a lot of them come in. But, you know, you could probably realize savings, you know, depending on what bonds are being refinanced, you know, probably over $50 million.
Chairman, is that
Senator Metzen.
$50 million, what, cumulative or yearly or what is that?
Chair, Senator, it would be $50 million spread over time. So it would be a total of $50 million, but it will be spread over the life of the bond issue.
Sure, similar have to... Have we accrued, like, the payments, or do we make those payments on the revenue side every year on a line item in the finance committee to pay the debt? Is that...
Chair, Senator, it's actually a general standing appropriation. Okay. So.
Well,
Senator Metzen.
So we're saving a lot of money each year, which is good. Could that leverage, should we be, of course, this is, we make this opinion, I hear, but I mean, it seems like a very good time to do some bonding with the savings and use some of that accrued money to pay off new bonds and also the 2.5%. So it seems to me, as one member here, it's time to kind of do some of these improvements, you know. And that's not for you to answer. That's my thinking, so.
I was just looking down that list of, I think we have about 135 bills introduced so far. And
is that all?
Senator Metzen, no.
Chair.
You're way ahead of me, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
Chair, Senator, we actually do look carefully at this and, you know, whether or not it is feasible, you know, to look at it during, you know, the legislative session and what kind of risks there are and things like that. So we do look at that, you know, and there's more complicated issues related to just, it's like refinancing your mortgage. But when you sell bonds, refunding bonds, you're selling enough bonds to pay off old bonds like you would with a home mortgage. But you have bonds that are maturing not just next year but years out that you're going to prepay or refinance. And so the proceeds of the refunding bonds go in what's called an escrow account to be able to make those payments. And the borrowing rate on the bonds is higher than what the investment rates are on the escrows. They're very low just because of so it's a shorter term period than the length of the bond issue. And so what happens is that you have to actually issue more bonds to fund the escrow to make sure there's enough money there to pay off the old bonds. And so that gets factored into the calculation. It's called negative arbitrage that, you know, we keep track of. And so even when interest rates go up, it's not necessarily a bad time to sell bonds because you'll also see interest rates going up in the escrow. So it might make the escrows more efficient. So, but we look at all of those things to realize savings to benefit the state. Other policies is that we traditionally sell bonds competitively. Our GO bonds, they're what would be considered a pretty plain vanilla deal. Minnesota is very respected in the bond market. People know what our credit is. But there are times when we, you know, use negotiated sales. We currently have the ability to do our GO bonds negotiated through the end of this fiscal year, because there are times that we do need to negotiate sales. There was a time in the late 2000s when the market crashed and we were bringing bonds to market, and there was things that were happening that the timing to sell something competitively because of what was happening in the market was not beneficial. So the ability to negotiate sales, to time it better, to be able to still sell bonds if you need the money in an interest rate environment that's not, that's more challenging than a normal interest rate environment, it's beneficial. It's just another tool in the toolbox, so we will be asking for an extension of that. We do use an independent financial advisor to help us through our sale process to get an idea of where the markets are, what the market is expecting in terms of call features to refinance bonds, and just get a sense of when we're coming to market, is there anything else in the market at the time? So that also goes to the timing of bond sales. When we sold our GO bonds in August, we were on the calendar first. There's a calendar, a bond calendar that we track. And about a week before the sale, I saw the state of Washington show up. Same credit rating, about the same par amount of bonds. They were GOs. So I called my financial advisor and I said, we got some competition here, so if you're bringing the same amount of bonds into the market that looks like a similar credit, you want to ask the question, is this a good time to sell? Should we postpone the sale? We decided not to just because there were some different features and how they're received in the market different than we are, and we did better than they did. So I was very proud of that. So there's lots of things that we have to consider when it comes to issuing debt, and that we have to pay attention on the state's behalf. So now I'm going to talk about the capital investment guidelines. This went to question that Senator Metzen has, and here's some history about capital investment guidelines. Back in the late 70s, The state actually had five guidelines that were established, and those five were that the debt was limited to 3% of the non-dedicated general fund revenues, that the principal amount of the GO bond debt should not exceed 2.5% of state personal income, that the total amount of all state agency debt outstanding should not exceed 3.5% of state personal income, the total amount of all state debt, looks like I missed a word, should not exceed 5% of state personal income, and then the 40-70 maturity test, which says that 40% of our GO bonds is paid off within 5 years and 70% within 10 years. And so there was this history where we had this, a lot of people discuss when they're talking about the guidelines that 3%. That was, for those of you that have been here, that 3% was in place for a long time, and so you will often hear reference to that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni?
I see it's in writing here, but is it in writing somewhere, or is it just one of these things that somebody came up with and decided that is?
Chair, Senator?
Commissioner?
Since I've only been at the state just over 2 years, my staff is nodding that, yes, we do have this in writing somewhere.
And is it, I mean, it says guidelines, so what does that mean exactly?
Well, they were actually called debt management guidelines.
Code, the Pirates Code is just a guideline also, so I'm just wondering what exactly this guideline means.
Well, kind of. Chair, Senator, what I look at is, you know, a guideline. It's not set in statute. It's not it's not a goal, not a target, but it gives some guidelines to, you know, how much debt, you know, when you're talking about, you know, bond issues and size of bond issues, because I wasn't here in the 70s when they were established, but it, you know, it talks about kind of your ability to pay. It talks about kind of an a manageable amount of debt. It talks about how fast you pay off the bonds.
Mr. Chairman, I heard a story of how we got the guideline, but I'm not sure that it's credible or not, but so I won't tell it here. But I'll tell you later. But was it established through the bonding committee? Was it established by the financial advisor? Was it established through a bonding house? How did we come up with the guideline, or where did it come from?
Chairman, Senator, it was an administrative. It did not come through the committee, but it was an administrative policy that was established.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hansen, to follow up, Senator Tomasoni is looking to raise that 3% to about 15%. my question is a little bit different. First of all, whether or not there's the ability to understand that you weren't there 30 years ago, whether or not there's the ability to figure to determine what the history is, you know, without doing a treatise on it, as to why the 3% figure was utilized by the Department of Finance back then, as opposed to some other figure. I don't know if there's anybody left who could help with the history, or if we could find out. I didn't think of past commissioners of finance, but
Chair, Senator, I actually probably have a resource that can help me do that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, that might be helpful, because what Senator Tomasoni asked is something that has come up periodically as to, you know, why the 3%. My second question, though, is contemporary. Are you aware of whether or not other states have similar kinds of guidelines, and if so, where we compare with those guidelines?
Chair, Senator, I'm going to the next slide, and some of my more of my discussion will help answer some of those questions.
We have another question, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, is the guidelines that we've been talking about, formal, informal, whatever they may be, somehow tied to the rating that would be assigned to the state of Minnesota?
Chair, Senator. Yes, it's one of the factors that they look at, and I'm going to talk in great length about our current capital investment guidelines, so that'll help answer some of the questions that are coming up here. So in 2009, so the slide before was the history of our guidelines, and that there were five in place. In 2009, there were new guidelines that were created, guidelines 1 and 2, and guideline 3 was old guideline 5, so that stayed in place. So From an administrative level, the original guidelines did not include all the debt that the rating agencies include in their calculations. The guidelines were created so that they were more in line with what the rating agencies analyze and look at, and it's more reflective of our ability to pay versus, you know, tying it to kind of the general fund. It's actually tied to personal income, and it's more simple and straightforward and comparable to what other states use. So that's what happened in 2009, is so that we now have three guidelines, and this is what they look like. Guideline one is that the total tax-supported principal outstanding, actual bonds that have been issued, shall be 3.25% or less of total state personal income. And so as of the November 2012 forecast, and these numbers will be updated tomorrow, but we have to work off of these numbers, the total principal outstanding was $6.9 billion, which equals 2.74% of the state personal income. And when we talk about total tax-supported principal outstanding, I do have on the back of your handout this sheet, which we will look at, but I want to talk about the guidelines first. But so while I'm talking about it, you can look at this sheet. But you can see it includes general obligation bonds. It includes the University of Minnesota bonds for the TCF Bank Stadium, as well as the biosciences buildings, which are university-issued bonds, but they're funded by a state general fund, you know, appropriation. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency actually has some debt outstanding, which the agency issued, but they're funded by general fund appropriations. So not only do you have geo bonds that are net supported, you know, tax supported, but you also have appropriations that are also net tax supported. So this includes our geo bonds as well as all of that other kind of appropriation debt as well. And we'll get into more details on that. But I just wanted to and it's all bonds that have been issued. Not that's what's authorized and unissued, but it's all outstanding debt that we currently have on the books. The remaining principal capacity as of the November forecast was $1.27 billion. And we send, you know, with the forecast documents, the debt capacity report to the chair of the Capital Investment Committee, so that can be shared with the committee tomorrow when those updated numbers are made available.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hansen, so what percentage of that $1.27 billion is authorized but not issued?
None. Guideline one is all issued debt. So guideline one is total tax-supported principal outstanding. So bonds that have been issued.
I understand.
Yep.
I understand. But there are some bonds that are authorized, but you haven't issued yet, correct?
Correct. So that's guideline two.
Senator
Nelson. Okay, so you've answered my question here.
Senator Nelson.
All right. I'm sorry. I'll be patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe for those of us who weren't here in 2009, talking about these different guidelines, I'm just curious if you can – I understand the difference and probably the wisdom in including all debt capacity, all outstanding debt, which the previous guidelines did not. I understand that. But I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit, if it's not too far afield, to just give me a little bit of your input on the efficacy of actually basing the percent on personal income as opposed to percent of the budget? That seems to have been a rather big change. And I don't want to take up too much time, but I would like maybe a sentence or two about why that might be a good idea.
Commissioner?
Chair, Senator, I can probably only give you a couple sentences since I was not here in 2009 either. But it goes to the general fund. And as you know, those numbers change. And personal income talks about our state personal income, more of an ability to pay than what's actually, you know, legislative act in terms of what the general fund actually is. And I can probably get more background on what happened in 2009, which would probably be helpful for your context. Mm-hmm. But I know that the initiative was to have them more in line with what the rating agencies are looking at. And you can see as one of the two of the handouts that are also in the back of your packet, it shows the most recent Moody's ranking of tax-supported debt. It's probably the second to the last page of the handout. It shows where we rank. I believe we're 27th. compared to all of the other states kind of goes to, you know, some of the questions that were raised. It's a table, and it also, there's another table I compiled that looks at where we rank on net tax-supported debt, because this is something that the rating agencies look at. They're not looking at, you know, general funds, you know, looking at it as a percentage of general fund, because every state has a different definition of general fund.
Senator
Mr.
Nelson?
Chair, I think you might have answered enough of the issue, which is if this is what the rating agencies are looking at,
yep.
If they're evaluating based upon personal income rather than the state general fund is what you're saying, correct? Thank you. That's what I need to know.
Commissioner?
Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Thomason.
To Senator Pappas's question, is guideline number one mean that if we wanted to take all those bills that Senator Stumpf has on his list there, we would have $1.27 billion of remaining bonding capacity for this particular biennium? Or is that what that means? Or?
Commissioner?
Chair, let me walk through the rest of the guidelines and then talk about how this all works together.
Right.
So guideline two looks at the total amount of tax-supported principal, both issued and authorized, as well as authorized and unissued. So that includes what we already have outstanding, and then it also includes what's been authorized in legislation of what we can issue. And we will look at detail at that actual spreadsheet, but you will see that in terms of GO bonds, we have $2 billion of authorized but unissued bonds, and about half of that is trunk highway, and half of it is GO bonds. And just kind of background is that when the state issues bonds and we size our bond issue and bring things to market, we sell the amount needed to fund the cash flow of projects that have been authorized. So when your local government, say a school district, votes on a bond issue and they vote on $15 million to add on to their building, what you will usually see is if the bond issue passes, they go to market right away or within a short time after the election and they sell all of those bonds. Because the state has hundreds and thousands of bond-authorized projects from, you know, current and previous bond issues, we don't want to go out and sell the entire bond amount, regardless of the size of the issue, because that money isn't going to be needed for the projects right away. As you know, most projects have a spend-down schedule, and, you know, even if it's a school building or a city hall, that project takes more than 6 months or a year or, in some cases, 2 or 3 years. So we only issue the amount of bonds that are needed so that we are not paying interest on debt that we're not using. So that's why you have, you know, $2 billion outstanding for projects, because the cash flow isn't showing we need them, but they're authorized and will be issued at some point based on the cash flows of all of those projects. So guideline two includes those pieces. It includes state moral obligation bonds. These are bonds that have been issued by the Housing Finance Authority as well as the Office of Higher Ed. These are bonds that are issued that have a debt service reserve, and in the event that they need to spend down that debt service reserve, in law, it's required that the governor ask the legislature for an appropriation to fund that debt service reserve, so we look at that as a liability to the state. Equipment capital leases, we have a master lease program that the state uses to fund the fleet, you know, Department of Administration, and also hard costs for minute for technology, and then we also have real estate capital leases included as well. So,
Mr. Chair, I have one question.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, just for clarity, Senator Nelson, I believe, just asked a question as it pertains to personal income. What constitutes personal income? Because I think you said that it does not. It is not the general fund. So can you define what the state's personal income is?
Chair, Senator, it's a number that the economists use that we get from Global Insights, you know, personal income. I will get more detail on what is constituted in that number so you have that background.
Thank you.
So and going back to guideline two, we currently have issued and authorized and unissued of about $11.6 billion, which is 4.62% of the state personal income. And as indicated, it shall not exceed 6%. So the remaining principal capacity is almost $3.5 billion based on the November forecast. And then Guideline 3, which is similar to the old Guideline 5, is that 40% of our state GO bonds are to mature within 5 years and 70% within 70 years. And those figures for June 30th were 35.6% and 67.9%. The reason that they're lower is that when the state issued the tobacco securitization bonds in 2011, the proceeds of those bonds were used to pay off GO bonds that were maturing earlier. And so that brought, because those GO bonds were essentially paid off by the proceeds of the tobacco settlement revenue bonds, it lowered those figures. And the rating agencies are all very aware of what happened there. And like I said, there was a question that came up about kind of what the rating agencies look at. Rating agencies look at a whole host of things, and this is just one piece of what they look at. And that Guideline 3, I've been told, is very conservative.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Let me try to take one more shot at Senator Pappas and Senator Tomasoni's question. And Guideline number 1, does that mean that we can go and still meet the guidelines, another $1.27 billion, and still be with the Guideline number 1, over and above what's not issued and what's issued, and still be kind of healthy? Is that the way to, Senator Tomasoni, is that kind of what we're trying to get at? Maybe we can take another shot at it.
Commissioner?
Chairman, Senator, this is an excellent time to look at this slide.
Yeah, you can really read it.
I almost feel like you're like Member, helping me work through the presentation.
Members, it's page 6 in that handout.
These are the actual numbers that we look at with the guidelines. This is page 6 of the debt capacity forecast. As I indicated, this is based on November 2012. And kind of the question is, does this mean that we can go out and you know, issue $1.3 billion and still be okay?
Author.
So if you look at the principal outstanding and all that's in that number right now, it's $6.9 billion. If you look at the authorized and unissued column, and our debt capacity forecast is a snapshot in time. And so if you look at it as a snapshot in time, it looks like, yes, we can just issue $1.3 billion or pass $1.3 billion bonding bill, but you need to also take into consideration the authorized and unissued column. Because at some point, we will be, this summer, we'll be issuing more GO bonds, which will take some of that $2 billion that's already in the unauthorized, and it'll move it over into Guideline 1. Because those folks that have received bond authorizations are in the middle of projects. When we issue bonds in the fall of 2012, we issue enough bonds to get them through the year. And so we keep track of the cash flow of all of the recipients of GO bond proceeds to find out, you know, when they're going to need more money so we can determine how big the bond issue is going to be when we go to market again. So if you ignored what's all authorized and unissued, the answer would be yes, you could do this $1.3 billion and issue more bonds. But you need to take into consideration that some of the $2 billion will move over into the issued, because we will be issuing some of those in August, and then that would appear in the next November forecast. So that's not will not be reflected in the February forecast. You can see that the Housing Finance Authority has $30 million of authorized and unissued debt that they will be issuing sometime. That's currently not in the, it hasn't been issued yet, but they will be issuing those bonds at some point, which will then move them into Guideline 1, and it'll affect that $1.271 billion. You can see that the professional football stadium appropriation bonds, at some time, you know, those bonds will be issued and will move over into the principal outstanding column and will affect Guideline 1. And then there was legislation passed in 2011 for that pay-for-performance program of $10 million that will move into there. So as a snapshot in time, it looks like we have that flexibility to do $1.27 million, when in fact some of the authorized and unissued will start moving into that principal outstanding probably sometime this summer and will affect the November debt capacity forecast and show that we don't have that 1.271.
Senator Nisgalski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. And then whatever actions that we take during this legislative session where we talk about bonding into the future, then that would come upon this authorized and unissued and would count against that guideline number two?
One. Correct.
But, Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Commissioner Hansen, guideline number two has a 6%.
Correct.
Limit. So it has a higher limit. And there's the capacity there where the $3.4 billion comes in.
Correct.
I had another question, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Pappas.
Even, you know, I mean, whether these guidelines are correct or strict or loose or whatever, however we want to categorize them, they do seem to me to be, you know, unless we think the 6% is fine, maybe a little too rigid, given the fact that there are times in our lives when we have very low interest rates, that maybe it is more advantageous for the state than to take advantage of low interest rates and increase its bonding capacity, and then in times of high interest rates to kind of cut back on that. Is there any consideration in any of the guidelines for the interest rate situation?
Chair, Senator, at this point in time, that is not factored into the calculation of the guidelines, and that's not anything that the rating agency would look at.
Mr. Chairman?
Rating agencies would not look at that.
Senator Tomasoni?
And does the 40-70 this slide at all?
Chair, Senator, the 40-70 really goes to when we're bringing bonds to market, how we structure them, and when principal is due. So that's something that we kind of administratively make sure that we're in compliance. But as I indicated, that's one small piece of what the rating agencies look at, and it's very conservative. So that's guidelines one and two are the guidelines that, you know, are more significant in what the rating agencies would look at.
Okay, but Mr. Chairman, and Mr.
Senator Tomasoni,
the 40-70 though says that 40% of the bonds are going to be paid off in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so does that does not affect these slides here, first of all, and
correct. The
Commissioner,
Chair, Senator, the slide that's before you just shows guidelines one and two, and so decisions made on kind of bonding authorization by the legislature clearly will affect this. It's more administrative guideline three that we make sure that when we issue the bonds that we're structuring them appropriately. But so
my point being that out of the $6.9 billion, 40% of that is going to be paid off in 5 years, correct?
Currently it's 35% right. Just because of the unique situation with the tobacco right. revenue bonds,
and,
but
and
yes.
My second question is on the professional football stadium, is that a revenue bond? I realize we have a state obligation for it, but is it not a revenue bond?
Chair, Senator Tomasoni, when that legislation was passed, those bonds are general fund appropriation bonds, not revenue bonds.
Aren't they supposed to be paid off by the gambling
Senator
tax?
Senator Tomasoni.
Or that just goes to the general fund, so it makes
general
it a general fund bond? Is that the reason? Or?
Chair, Senator, the intent of the legislation is that the gambling revenues would be sufficient to offset the cost of the general fund.
It seems like the question that seems to be hovering around is what size of a bonding bill would we be able to do this year in 2013?
Chair, members of the committee, since we have a new debt capacity forecast coming out tomorrow.
Stay tuned.
It's right, because those questions are being asked, and we want to be able to give you, you know, answer that question because similar questions are coming up from the House as well. And so we, instead of basing it on this stagnant data, which will be old in less than, you know, 24 hours, we are doing that analysis.
Okay.
We will be doing that analysis. We're not doing it yet.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if I'm on the right line, the right track, even using this stale data. If you look at the estimated maximum additional principal capacity for all obligations at 6%, that's roughly $3.4 billion.
Correct.
And if you subtract the authorized but unissued debt, that's $2.6 billion. And that would leave us with a remainder of $800 million. Is that, like, kind of the ballpark?
Chair, Senator?
Sure.
Guideline.
Right. Yeah.
There's more factors that will come into play because some of the principal outstanding, as of the next November forecast, because a lot of our GO bonds, the maturity schedule is the principal matures in August.
Mm-hmm.
That some of that will be
we'll
paid
retire.
Out. So there'll be bonds that will be retiring that will play into that as well.
So it could be higher.
But your analysis is probably a very conservative one.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's Commissioner, me. I'm going to take a run at the same question again. It's the same question that Senator Metzen and Senator Pappas and Senator Tomasoni and Senator Stump are trying to get an answer to, and I am interested in an answer. So keeping in mind that there will be a new forecast out tomorrow, and keeping in mind that you, of course, will be at liberty to adjust your answer accordingly after tomorrow, and using the figures that are on page 6 that you have in front of you, keeping in mind the guidelines that you have now gone through that you take into consideration when you make recommendations for bonding. What is the dollar amount of bonding that would be available to us as legislators in the year 2013, as of right now?
Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator, I'm not trying to be evasive, because if you remember, part of my earlier conversation is that when you pass a bonding bill, is that we don't issue all those bonds at once. So it'll show up in guideline 2, but that the dollars get spent over time, and so it would require, instead of just a black and white, you know, this is what it is, kind of, you know, what Senator Pappas said, if we did this calculation, it looks like we could do $800 million, but we don't issue the $800 million right away, so it doesn't show up in Guideline 1. And so we would really like to do the analysis based on tomorrow's forecast, because we want to give you all that same information, both the Senate and the House, and what all the moving parts are.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's good.
Commissioner, you mentioned that the February forecast will come out tomorrow, but we'll know even more when the November 2013. So what I'm trying to get at is, generally speaking, odd number years are not bonding years. Even number years are bonding years. And is that the reason why? Because we base that off the November forecast in the odd number year?
Chair, Senator, the reason the debt capacity forecasts kind of by statute come out on the same day as the actual forecast. So that's what drives when we do the debt capacity forecast.
Okay, and that's, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, and that's the November 2013
correct
forecast.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I apologize if you said this while I was out in the hall, but based on the fact that it looks like a lot of the question has been answered numerous times, and it's difficult to actually get to the answer. My question is, how does Guideline 1 and 2, how do those two moving pieces work together? There must be some sort of formula or some spreadsheet that as Guideline 1 reaches a certain percent, Guideline 2 has less capacity, or are they totally independent guidelines? How do these Guidelines 1 and 2 work together?
Commissioner?
Chair, Senator, since I wasn't here when they were established, I will get that answer to you. But I mean, it's for the state to track what's already been authorized, so we know what's going to move into Guideline 1. But like I said, when they were established, it was a snapshot in time. And so a lot of the questions now are, well, we need to look forward so that you can make policy decisions, and that traditionally has not been the case when these guidelines were set up, but it's important for you, for us to look forward and look what is going to be issued in moving into guideline one so you know what your parameters are. So that's what we're going to try to do once the forecast comes out tomorrow, is do some of that forward thinking so we can provide that information to you.
Commissioner, what would happen if a legislature passed legislation that went significantly above those guidelines?
Chairman, these guidelines are guidelines. They're not statute. And so you would be over the guidelines, and the rating agencies would look at that accordingly.
But would the fallout be higher interest rates?
Chair, it would all depend on what the bond rating is. And I do have a slide coming up talking about those things.
Please go ahead.
So just to kind of review what's included in the guidelines, I'll go through these quickly. Guideline one includes our state general obligation various purpose bonds. And these are the state-issued debt that shows up in guideline one, our state GO trunk highway bonds, our state general fund appropriation bonds. It does not include self-supporting debt, which would be revenue debt. There was a question that came up about kind of revenue bonds. We have 911 revenue bonds outstanding, which are supported by a specific revenue stream, and the pension building revenue bonds. So those are not included because they're supported by not net tax-supported debt, but they're supported by their own revenue stream. Other types of state obligations that would be included in Guideline 1 as well as Guideline 2 are state standing appropriations, the University of Minnesota, the TCF Bank Stadium, Biosciences, and the Housing Finance Agency debt that's supported by appropriation. It's that specific Housing Finance Agency debt. We also have the lease purchase for financing equipment. Certificates of participation were issued several years ago to fund the SWIFT project, as well as a tax integration project over at Department of Revenue. And there's also the lease purchase financing for real estate. Those were bonds issued by the St. Paul Port Authority to finance the construction of the Anderson and Freeman buildings, which are also supported by kind of the state appropriation. And the City of Bemidji issued debt for the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So that's all included in Guideline 1. Guideline 2, which we talked about, what's already issued but also authorized and unissued. So it's all the debt that we've talked about in Guideline 1. Plus, we also have lease purchase financing for equipment and the moral obligation commitments that we have at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Office of Higher Ed. At this point, I want to talk about there's currently legislation out there for that, the big economic development project in the city of Rochester. And there's a debt component to that. And you probably want to know where that falls in these guidelines. The current proposal, and I've not read the current law, but I'm familiar with some of the pieces, is it's kind of the state would not be issuing the debt. They're proposing to establish an authority kind of similar to economic development authorities, port authorities, housing redevelopment authorities that your local cities and counties have that's authorized in statute. So it would be an authority that would issue the obligations, and then the payment of the debt would be paid for. And this is debt that would be issued to fund public infrastructure. And the debt payments would be essentially paid by kind of an appropriation from the state that would get sent to the authority to make their debt payments. I know that they are talking about tax increment in a much bigger sense than we traditionally know tax increment, which is based on property taxes that involve income taxes and sales taxes and things like that. So it's broader than the traditional property tax increment, and it would be increment that would go into the state's general fund based on the private investment and economic development that would be happening in Rochester. And I know they have some sort of threshold that the state would not appropriate money until a certain dollar amount of increment is received by the state. So what would happen should that legislation go through kind of as it's drafted right now, that they're proposing that up to $585 million of, you know, debt to be supported by general fund appropriation, which would be offset by that increment, would, if the bill is authorized, it would put $585 million into Guideline 2. Depending on kind of, there's also talk about other local government sources and other funding sources. And then as the bonds get issued, then like any other authorization, they would move into Guideline 1. Just so you have kind of that background, because my guess is at some point that bill will probably be heard in your committee because of the bonding component. And I will kind of skip through the current amount outstanding because it ties out to that one spreadsheet. But there were a lot of questions kind of raised. Oh.
Senator Nelson.
I'll wait, but I do have a question at the end of the presentation.
Sure. We're going to have to keep moving here because we do want to cover the public facilities yet. So.
Chair, the rest of the slides will be quick. Bond ratings, as you know, bonds can be rated by one or more of the three major rating agencies, Fitch Ratings, Moody's Investor Service, S&P. Our bonds are all rated by all three of the rating agencies, and a bond rating is a measure of credit risk to investors, AAA being the highest rating, D are bonds in default. And the higher the credit rating is, the lower the risk to the investors as well as the lower the interest cost. Currently, the state of Minnesota bond ratings for our GO bonds, S&P and Fitch have us assigned a AA-plus rating. Moody's is AA-1 with a negative outlook. The state appropriation bonds are AA by Fitch and S&P. And the 911 revenue bonds, which I said are supported by a different revenue stream, Fitch has a AA, Moody's a double or an AA3, and S&P a AA-plus. And as you probably know, is that in 2011, S&P and Fitch currently had us at AAA, and we were downgraded in 2011. Fitch downgraded us in July of 2011, and S&P downgraded us in September of 2011. Other federal tax considerations, which I've kind of touched on, the whole tax exemption and the IRS regulation, arbitrage is something that we need to be to always watch. In this interest rate environment, it's not an issue, but the IRS does not want tax-exempt issuers of bonds to take advantage of our tax-exempt status and then, you know, sell bonds and then be able to turn around and invest them at a higher interest rate than what we're borrowing. That's not the intent of tax-exempt bonds, and so there's arbitrage regulations. Disclosure, this is Rule 15C212 of the SEC, happened in 1995 with Orange County, where at that time the only thing that investors had about a bond issue was the original offering statement. Now the SEC requires annual disclosure that's available to bondholders, and there's other things that we need to file, whether they're voluntary disclosures or material event notices. We had to file with make a filing when our bond ratings go down. So everybody has information all at the same time. And then just talking about that tax-exempt bond, the enforcement that they're looking at, how issuers are using their tax-exempt bond proceeds to make sure we're not in violation.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Chairman and Commissioner, what do you think it'll take to get back the AAA ratings is one question. The second question is, you've got some supporting data. This is the first time I've seen where other states are, and apparently no state has a AAA rating at this point. Is that at least these appear to be Moody ratings. Is that correct?
This is how all the states rate against each other. They all have different bond ratings. There are states that have a AAA rating. I think the state of Maryland, I saw they're going to market. They're a pure AAA. And I can put together that data so you can see, you know, kind of compare that chart to so where the others are. Okay. But you can imagine that the state of Illinois does not have as high of ratings as, you know, we do. But I can get that data. I do have a really great map, but I want to make sure it was provided by a private vendor. So before I publicly share it, it's really helpful. It shows what all the ratings are. You can see where.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, that would be helpful. But just offhand, if you know, just a ballpark, how many states have AAA ratings currently?
I would say it's about 20% of the states.
I'm sorry,
20% of the states have AAA ratings. And, and I'm just saying that I'm not talking about a pure – when I talk about a pure AAA, it means that all three ratings carry a AAA for those particular states. But I would say it's about, 20% at least have a AAA rating from at least one of the rating agencies.
And, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hansen, how would we get back our AAA rating? And when would we get it back?
Commissioner?
Chair.
I realize you can't speak for the rating agencies, but if you were to hazard a guess.
Chair, Senator, I'm actually not going to hazard a guess, but what I do want to talk about is when rating agencies look at the credit of an issuer, they look at, we're focusing here just on the debt guidelines and how much debt we have outstanding. They actually look at the state's economy, how diverse our economy is, what some of our economic statistics are, unemployment rates, things like that. They also look at the financial management of the state, what kind of practices are in place for managing, the state's finances. They actually look at what's happening, legislatively. Fitch, when they downgraded us in July of 2011, that was actually before the special session. One of the things they cited in that downgrade report was just the fact that the state was discussing using tobacco bonds was one of the factors they downgraded us on. And so they look at our outstanding debt. They look at kind of what's happening, policy decisions legislatively, financial management decisions, the state's economy. They look at all of these things as a whole. They look at pension liabilities. They're starting to look at those as a debt capacity. Right now we've been downgraded. It seems like it's easier to get downgraded than it is to get upgraded. And like I said, we currently have a negative outlook on our Moody's rating. And, as we know with some of, more recent forecasts, things have been improving. And so we always kind of ask, when is that negative outlook going to go off? And, they say, we need to show a history of, good management practices and things like that. So it does take a long time to get ratings upgraded once they've been downgraded.
So, Mr. Chairman, just one final question on that. The governor's proposed a budget that's structurally balanced, which we haven't seen in 10, 11 years around here. But I infer from your comments that it's going to take more than, say, one biennial budget to get back to that AAA. That simply if at the end of this year's session we have a budget that the agencies would look at and see that it's in structurally better shape than we've had in the past, it's not going to be quite that simple.
Chair, Senator, I think that's a fair comment. These are just future debt issuance plans. The St. Paul Port Authority is looking at refinancing those bonds, which would also affect Guideline 1. There'd be less bonds outstanding. Looking at refundings, stadium appropriation bonds, pay-for-performance appropriation bonds, our state GOs, which we'll sell this summer. The University of Minnesota still has remaining authorization for their biosciences buildings. And then, as you saw in the Guideline 2, MHFA has that $30 million that's been authorized and unissued that at some point will be issued.
Senator Metzen.
On the housing finance, those are revenue bonds, aren't they, not GO bonds?
Commissioner?
Chair.
There's a method. There's Senator, a stream of repayment there, right?
Minnesota Housing Finance has the authority to issue debt, and they have a lot of debt outstanding revenue bonds. There's specific programs that were authorized in statute. That one was passed in the 2012 bonding bill, that additional $30 million, which is actually supported by state's appropriation.
State appropriation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, general fund appropriation.
I would think that
Senator Metzen.
Their buildings and what they do, a lot of it would get a return, I think. But that's not the case, huh?
Yeah, they.
I'm trying to make a case that this $68 million on the housing finance stuff, I know it's technically a state obligation, but you could somehow separate it because it's revenue, but maybe I'm wrong.
Chair, Senator, in this case it's not. Those two bonds, there's some that have already been issued under a separate authorization, and the ones that were recently authorized, those aren't revenue bonds. They are truly a specific purpose that are funded by state general fund appropriations.
Okay, Commissioner.
Chair, for the purpose of time, I would, you know, at this point, you know, it sounds like you have one more question for me and others might have, but I want to be sensitive to the committee.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about, you didn't mention STAR bonds, state tax anticipated revenue bonds, and I'm just curious if we've done those in Minnesota. I know some states have, and it looks from your look, maybe we haven't, I don't know, but how would STAR bonds impact our guidelines?
Chair, Senator, the state has not issued those types of bonds, and I'm not familiar with them, but I will now do research.
I would like to know more about STAR bonds. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner.
You're welcome.
A lot of good information to, and we'll, it'll be all updated tomorrow, or at least some of it will be updated tomorrow.
And, Chair, hopefully we'll be able to provide answers to the multiple senators that asked the same question in different ways.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Just relative to that, possibly with the forecast and then the debt capacity work you'll be doing, maybe you could get a letter, unless, Mr. Chairman, you intend to have the commissioner back in front of us, possibly you could send a letter to the chairman and the ranking minority member with the information that several members have asked about so that the committee does have the answers.
If you want to get it to our office, I can send it out to all the members of the committee. So, great. Thank you. Members, we have also the Public Facilities Authority, and I don't know how much we'll be able to get into it, but I really would like to at least give everybody some exposure. I know most of the members on this committee have been around the this area. But last night when I was going over the some of the information on it, it was kind of like one of those moments, a revelation as to what kind of a wonderful piece of legislation this was. And I think it was back in, was it the 80s or 90s when it was passed? And I think we all, at least personally, I've kind of looked upon it more as a tool for wastewater, clean water generally, but I think it's a whole lot more than that, and hopefully we'll get a good overview of this. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. Many of you probably know and remember Terry Poolman, who was the Executive Director for many years, and I was his deputy. And Terry retired last summer, and I was appointed to be the Executive Director. So I'm happy to be here with you today. I think you have in your packets a handout that looks like this, has our little pipe logo at the top. The Public Facilities Authority is a multi-agency financing authority that provides infrastructure financing programs and municipal financing expertise primarily to help local governments finance water infrastructure projects, wastewater and drinking water specifically. Public Facilities Authority is an independent state agency. We're governed by a board that consists of six state commissioners, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Management and Budget, Health Department, Agriculture, Transportation, and the Pollution Control Agency. The PFA essentially is an infrastructure bank. We manage investments and transactions of three revolving loan funds and several other grant programs in conjunction with our various member agencies. The member agencies have a role in setting project priorities, conducting technical environmental project reviews, PFA staff focuses on doing credit reviews of the loan applicants, the local government units, setting loan terms and conditions, servicing the loans, coordinating funding with other sources, and providing the overall fund management and administration. We also help local governments understand the funding process, which can be kind of complicated, the program requirements, and as well as their own local responsibilities. PFA has statutory authority to sell up to $1.5 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds, totally separate from the state GO bonds. These are revenue bonds that are supported by repayments of the loans that we made primarily. The revenue bonds are rated AAA by all three rating agencies, repaid from the loan repayments, as I said, and interest earnings. There's no state backing to these bonds. Currently, we have about $1.1 billion outstanding and total assets of about $2.3 billion. PFA receives no state general funds for program administration. All of our admin funds come from fee on loan repayments and a small set-aside from the federal funds that we receive. In total, our admin expenses are about 1% of the total financing that we provide. We're a small, very small agency. We have eight FTEs working for the PFA. We get some support functions provided by DEED. We also have interagency agreements with the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department, where we pay for staff in those departments to do the technical reviews and other administrative responsibilities related to our programs. The backside of the first page has a kind of an organization chart that shows the different agencies that make up the PFA board. The chair is the Commissioner of Deed, Katie Clark Sieben. And then you can see each department and kind of the program functions that they have a role in. Our largest programs down on the kind of the lower left are the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund and some of the related programs that focus on wastewater, as well as more and more some stormwater issues as well. The next page gets into a little more detail of the PFA programs. We have what we would consider our base programs. The Clean Water Revolving Fund is by far our largest program. These are our low-interest, below-market rate loans. In total, we've, since 1989, provided $2.5 billion in loan financing to local governments. And because they're made at below-market interest rates, we do calculate estimated interest savings on all of our loans, which on those clean water loans to date is about $612 million. The program equity in the is provided through an annual federal capitalization grant, which last year was about $26 million, and a 20% state match that comes through state GO bond appropriations to the Clean Water Revolving Fund. And then we leverage those state and local funds by issuing our revenue bonds to generate additional loan dollars. To date, each $1 of state funds has provided or generated over $14 in construction financing and over $3 in interest savings. Currently, we've got about $200 million in loan requests on our current intended use plan is our project list, and we've told those cities we're prepared and ready to finance those projects as soon as they receive the necessary approvals and take bids. We don't finance projects until they are ready to go to construction. The other base program is the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, our WIF program, which is supplemental assistance grants to address high-cost wastewater projects. Those grants can either be packaged with our low-interest clean water loans or match with USDA Rural Development that also provides loan and grant financing focusing on small rural communities. Those grants are based on an affordability criteria That is 1.4% of median household income of the community. We look at both the debt service costs and the O&M costs, operation and maintenance costs that that community has. For an average small rural community, that 1.4% comes out to about $45 to $50 a month. So that's a pretty high bar that a city's costs of their system would have to reach that level before the any kind of grant funds would kick in. We also manage and administer three programs that are funded through the Clean Water Legacy Fund, the dedicated sales tax money. You can see those listed at the bottom. These are programs that essentially provide some additional help to cities when they are required through their permit to provide some additional level of treatment over and above what they would otherwise have to do to address an impaired water or some other specific water quality goal. These programs, the governor has proposed $22 million in his budget for these programs. We also have a technical agency bill that we want to tweak the programs a little bit to make them a little more work better and more accessible to communities. The note at the bottom is important. All of our PFA clean water programs follow the Pollution Control Agency's project priority list, which ranks projects on environmental and public health criteria. And by following that list, and cities get on the list and they work through the preliminary planning and engineering design phases, which can take several years on these projects. They get to be kind of complicated, but a city knows based on what their point value is and where they are on the list, what their chances for funding are, and we're able to tell a city our cutoff for the loan program has been 45 points on the list for many years, and so a city knows if they're above that level, they can work through all of those preliminary steps and know that at least the loan funding would be available for them once they're ready to go to construction. On the back side, just real quickly, we have a drinking water revolving fund that works very similarly. It's a newer program, and the dollars are a little smaller, but it works very similar to the clean water revolving fund. We also have a small transportation revolving loan fund, much smaller than the other two programs, but it does kind of fill a niche for primarily to help local governments pay for their share of a larger transportation project. You can see last year we did two loans, one to the city of Albertville to help their share of a new freeway interchange around the outlet mall, and city of Nisswa for improvements to Highway 371 through the city. Finally, at the bottom of the page, we do also administer a credit enhancement program. There's no direct funding through this program, but cities that are issuing their own general obligation bonds, cities and counties issuing GO bonds in the private market for specific eligible activities can apply for a credit enhancement, which essentially it's a limited state guarantee of the debt service on those local bonds so that the cities get a higher bond rating on their bonds and are able to achieve some interest savings. The next couple pages just show by fiscal year total loans that we've made since 1990 with the Clean Water Revolving Fund, and the average interest rate and the average discount from the market rate at the time and the interest savings then that we've calculated based on that. You can also see how the loans have been spread out throughout the various regions of the state. Backside shows that same kind of a chart for the drinking water program. And then there's a bar chart, or two bar charts on the next page, that illustrate the leveraging and kind of the bang for the buck that we're able to achieve with the green bars being the project financing that we've done in each year over the past 10 years, and the blue and the red showing the federal and the state match that we've received. So you see that for a fairly small amount of federal and state funds, we're able to generate a lot of financing for local projects. And then after that, you get into the green sheets, which is the total project priority list for the clean water program, primarily wastewater treatment projects. And they're ranked in priority order 1 through, I think, 340. The total and the ranking is based on PCA's point criteria, environmental and public health factors. The total list is about $1.4 billion. These projects are in various stages. Not all of them are ready for construction right now. It's roughly a five-year list of projects. And we don't, as I mentioned, we don't fund the projects until they're ready to start construction. As I said, $1.4 billion in total. It wasn't that many years ago that we had a list that was for several years was well over $2 billion. So we have funded a lot of projects, especially in recent years, and have been able to, and that decrease from $2 billion to $1.4 billion, it's not, we haven't funded everything. There's been other, the USDA Rural Development Funds projects, and of course cities. For various reasons, some cities fund certain projects on their own through private market or through cash reserves that they've built up. So it's a combination of all that, but we are sort of working down on the total list of needs. Of course, every year there's also new projects that get added because, like roads and bridges and everything else, wastewater infrastructure wears out over time. Needs to be rehabilitated, replaced, and various components need to be upgraded. So going across the columns, and I won't go into much detail, but you can see a little project description that gets cut off on a lot of these, the total cost, and then the various funding programs and the dollars that we estimate communities and projects are eligible for under our various programs. Any project with a dollar figure under the column that says CWRF loan 2013 IUP fundable range, those are the projects that have completed the planning work and given us a request saying they want to try to go to construction this year in 2013. And so those are the projects. Some of them we've already funded. Those are the shaded bars that go across. Others are working towards final engineering approvals and getting their projects going. Some of them may get delayed for one reason or another and fall into next year. But approximately $200 million worth of projects that are working towards construction this year. That's about double what our long-term average lending capacity is of the fund, which is roughly $100 million if we receive no further state or federal support, just the revolving program on its own. Back to the bar charts, you can see most years we funded significantly more than $100 million. We're able to do that because in the short term we can fund more, but that obviously then hurts sort of the future or the long-term lending capacity, which is why we're hopeful and always looking for that continued state and federal support through the federal grants and the state match to keep building that loan capacity. Last year's bonding bill, our two-year, the governor's request for 2 years of state match was cut down to 1 year. So we will be, if there is a bonding bill this year, that's always our number one priority is the state match to the federal dollars. The other big program with respect to the bonding bill, the WIF program, you can see some columns there for projects that had money awarded or reserved from prior appropriations, as well as last year's bonding bill appropriated $15 million for the WIF program. You can see where those funds went. And then there's a column for WIF grant estimated need based on the affordability criteria. These are the estimated grants that those projects would be eligible for. As I mentioned, not all of these projects are ready to go to construction. So when the time comes to look more closely at a bonding appropriation, we always look at what's the need for projects that are kind of ready to go, and we'll look more closely at that time. You can see the legacy projects or the legacy programs and the communities that have applied for those funds this year. And then on the far right are the other funders that we coordinate with, primarily USDA Rural Development, also the DEED Small Cities Development Program, which is some HUD block grant funds that some of those are available for infrastructure improvements for small communities. And then a few other sources as well to the right. Following the green pages, there's an alphabetical list if you're looking for a particular community. And then at the following that, there are the blue sheets, which is the same idea for the drinking water program. Projects ranked based on public health criteria by the health department and the various programs that they're eligible for, and the ones that are on this year's list and working towards construction this year. So I'll stop there. Try to go fast, and I know you're running out of time, but
a couple questions that I have. The benefit for communities and the reason the communities come to you, they could go, some smaller communities that probably don't have the resources, it looks like a lot of the working out or solving the problems, whether it's who they have to go through, the permits, the funding, the financing of it, can be done kind of through your office. So the benefit to a lot of those smaller communities, rather than getting trying to solve the financing of a project, or some of the small communities, I'm sure, get a consultant or somebody to work with, but they could actually come to your office and work through the same solutions, right, or same problems.
Senator, all of our, we have loan officers that work with all the communities on the list, and some communities need more help than others as far as kind of helping understand the funding process, understand what their responsibilities are. All of them would have a consulting engineer that'll help with the engineering aspects of the project, but we do help communities to look at what their revenues and if they have to implement rate increases, which they often usually do to take on a big project. We help them look at what those rate increases would be and how they can maybe phase those in over time, as well as we're coordinating with our partners at the Pollution Control Agency or the Health Department to make sure that the engineering and the environmental review and those things are kind of happening concurrently, so it all hopefully comes together as soon as possible, and when the city's ready to do the project, all the pieces are in place.
And one of the benefits is that you have loans, you have grants, you have federal money, or the, I don't know if you have access to the federal money, but you have, you can direct them to where to go. The other one is the question I have is under the credit enhancement program, when did that actually start? Was that part of the original legislation when it was passed?
No, Senator, members, that credit enhancement program is newer. I'm thinking approximately 10 years ago that program began. And as a way to Actually, it originally began to help counties with specific types of law enforcement and social service facilities. Cities were added a few years later as an eligible applicant specifically for sewer, water, infrastructure as a way to, if a city was too low on our list for us to provide direct funding, or if for some reason the nature of the project was such that maybe a little smaller project or something that they felt it wasn't necessary to go through the full process and they were going to do their own bonds, which cities do all the time, and this is a way for especially smaller communities to get a better interest rate by that state backing, which gives them the higher bond rating.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for you. When I was looking through all the different sheets and they had rankings, priorities, or so on, and my question is, how do you get to the top of the list or the bottom of the list in its clearest way being stated on what are some of the criteria? The second thing is I noticed several times there are multiple number one. How long does it take to get down the list to, say, number 30 or 50 or so on?
Mr. Freeman? The ranking criteria, and this is done by the Health Department and PCA, so I'll give you kind of the general overview answer. They have established in their rules criteria that assign points based on environmental and public health criteria. So on the wastewater list, it's partly driven by the age and condition of the existing facility and whether it's reaching, if especially in a growing community, if a city treatment plant is nearing its capacity and they need to expand or something like that, that's part of the point calculations, as well as if the city is being required to provide some additional treatment. Phosphorus treatment is one of the common ones, and now as the TMDL impaired water process is going on, that can give extra points to a community as well. So it's driven by kind of from a state perspective, what's the environmental priority and also public health related priority of that project. The 1 point projects are really just what all that really means is they've made the initial application, but they haven't yet submitted and pulled together the more detailed information for PCA to kind of calculate the score. So they're kind of like they've got their foot in the door and they're working on putting together the more detailed information to find out what their real score is. So that's they don't stay at 1 point typically. They'll move up once more information is available.
Any other questions? In the governor's budget, what were the recommendations that he had for some aspects of these programs? Do you know?
The governor's budget includes the recommendations for the dedicated clean water legacy funds, in particular for PFA, and that's those three programs that I mentioned on the bottom of the second page, or I guess third page, and the total $22 million, most of that for the TMDL grants, and as I mentioned, a technical bill. We're hoping to merge the TMDL and the phosphorus grants into one program and streamline it a little bit. The governor's request is $18 million for those programs combined, and then $4 million for the small community wastewater program, which focuses on very small, unsewered communities. Typically 20 to 30 households or less, where they're kind of ideally, where there's failing septic systems, ideally the individual homeowners would replace and fix those septic systems on their own, perhaps with some there are other programs to help. But in a lot of cases, the lots are too small, the soils are bad, the groundwater is high, the people can't do it on their own individual lot, and they have to look at some kind of community solution, and that program specifically targets those kind of cities. Okay. Or sometimes townships or parts of townships.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. There are no other questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Freeman. And I think that's it. If there's no other questions, the committee will adjourn. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Kiffmeyer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, to stand between adjournment here, but and maybe this was covered before. I know that one of the things I've seen going around the Capitol is some tours, and with our restructuring, was there some comment already made about the committee touring the Capitol and some of the structure?
Senator Kiffmeyer, I think we can organize that. Senator Saxhog's State Government Committee had a tour. If you would like, we could organize that for you.
I think that'd be really good to do.
I think there have been a couple of different tours that we have had. It is very interesting. I mean, to see exactly what's going to happen, at least in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any total solution yet as to where we're going to be. I mean, it's going to happen this summer, some of it. So, but if you'd like, we could organize that for you.
That would be great, Mr. Chairman. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. Committee is adjourned.